This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Doing more with less, like low-cost airlines and discount supermarkets, sounds like a good idea, but must quality be sacrificed for affordability? Good afternoon, I'm Lee Chui Lin, and my guest today on Live and Learn says, absolutely not. Dr. Amani Salim is a big advocate of frugal innovation and is assistant professor of biotechnology engineering. She was previously the principal investigator to NASA's SporeSat. I'm going to ask her more about that, as well as rocket science, space biology, and frugal technology. Welcome to the show, Dr. Amani.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
You're the first Malaysian woman to work on NASA's SporeSat. What is it?
So SporeSat is actually it's a NASA small satellite project called a nano-satellite project. So spore meaning the biology that you're studying. Sat is a satellite. So it's basically studying biology by sending things to space using a small satellite that piggyback on a Dragon Falcon 9 rocket.
What are some of the things that you would send into space?
Some of the things we send to space are very interesting things, such as, spore of a fern, Pakupakis. We use it because we send it to space because it's a single cell, single plant cells. So if you want to understand, for example, how do these cells sense gravity? So you need to take out a factor of gravity. So that's why we send those things to space. Other things people send to microgravity environment in space are such as crystals and so forth, to see crystal formation, which is non-living things, and also living things such as the fern spore, for example.
How did you get involved in this particular mission?
It was actually, well, people said it's luck, but it's also hard work. So I was a PhD student when I was at Purdue University, and then one of my committee members who evaluated my thesis, he always see my progress in doing the work. And he was like, well, you know, she tends to make things that are impossible possible. So devices that people think can never work, I will make it work. And that thing is required to involve in satellite projects, and that's how I got invited to go to lead a nano-satellite project myself.
What practical real-world applications does the project lead to?
So, for example, a lot of these devices, you put spores in them to understand the fundamentals, right? At the same time, this device can be used on Earth. For example, you can put cells in these devices, and then it measures ions concentration from single cells. You can see the effect of drugs and so forth on cells, you know, in vitro, outside of the body. So you can actually do a lot of study even on Earth. So it's not just for the rocket science, you know, going to space, but it can be applied on Earth as well.
What was it like working at NASA?
Very exciting. So the best part working with NASA is you get to work with people of various backgrounds, people from different countries. You don't get that a lot when I was in my education system, where mostly you're channeled into one type, you know, or two or three. But over there you have people from, like, you know, from Germany, from all over the world. So that's the most exciting part of working in NASA.
I think towards maybe earlier this year and towards the end of last year, conversations about women in science, and in fact, this year overall, conversations about women in science have really intensified. People have wondered whether there's an element of sexism. People have wondered why it is that we don't have more girls, more women involved in things like engineering. And what would your response be to that? You know, did you ever feel that being a woman was made things harder?
Well, yes and no. There are times where, because a lot of my involvement in science is in the West, which is the United States, where there's a lot of encouragement towards women to actually pursue science and be a leader in science. Not just, pursuing science, but to lead a project. So they have a lot of push in that. A lot of the challenges come from these stereotypes from back home, actually, which is in Malaysia, where my personal experience, not talking about everybody, but it's just that, you know, like, you need to reach a certain milestone at a certain stage in your life. Why put effort in science? Because it's a lot of sacrifice to do science. So you have to do things at a certain time, which sometimes, you know, maybe you don't want that. you want to do the great things, you know, how many people you can get married anytime, for example, but how many times you can lead a nano site projects. So having, luckily, I have a strong support system from my family. In terms of colleagues, in United States, I have a lot of support from the male colleagues as well, and also the female colleagues. In Malaysia also. But then there's this stereotype where women, they're good in science, but then to be a leader, to lead something, there's still some, I feel, there seems some hold back in that, which we need to push out, because a lot of women are entering science these days, and that's very important for them to be the leading faces in science so that it encourages women and girls to be in the field.
Considering that you had good support in the United States and that you spent more than 10 years studying and then working there as well, why did you decide to return to Malaysia and come home?
Well, basically because of love for my country and my people. It is a lot of my friends, if you ask, who came back to Malaysia, they just want to make a change in the country. I came back with that drive and passion. So it's not, and of course, you know, family is a big motivation for you to come back. You know, your parents are getting old and so forth. At the same time, you know, teaching and encouraging your own Malaysian people, the satisfaction you felt is a little bit different. It's not that, you know, I don't love my students in the United States. I do. But it's just that they have a lot of role models there. We don't have many role models that we can see here. Maybe they are, but maybe they're not in the public sphere. So people don't know about them. So my ability to even talk about what I love and so that it can encourage women and girls is something I'm passionate about.
Growing up, did you have role models that you could look up to in the field of science?
In the field of science, actually, my parents are not in the science field. But even though they're not, my mother, my father bought these encyclopedias and so forth where it nurtured that interest in science. So they said, pursue your interests, regardless of science, arts, whatever you love. So this is sort of something that I like the science. So they were like, there's nothing wrong with it. Even though my parents are not scientists, they're not the type, well, you must follow what your father is or your mother is. Be a lawyer, you know, be in the field that they are in, which is not what they do to me. Explore what you like and go with it.
What has been the biggest adjustment you've had to make since coming home? I would imagine that it's quite different. I mean, I've not attended either of the universities that you've been to, but I would think that, yeah, I mean, just in terms of facilities, in terms of culture.
Yes. So coming home to Malaysia, the easiest transition is the food, because food is great here and they're pretty affordable. So that's something I don't need to have a lot of transition to. But coming to Malaysia is one of the challenges I have is you start from nothing. Okay, so basically the science that you do maybe don't have researchers who work on it before. So you're the pioneer in things. Now, being a pioneer in things, a little bit more difficult than being something, you know, you build on top of things that's already existing. So I'm sort of like a pioneer in my institution. It's not that the institution doesn't have things. They do, but maybe not to my research. So I have to build that and contribute to the institution in that way. So that's the greater challenge.
You are a big advocate of frugal innovation. Could you explain what it is? I mean, it sounds self-explanatory, but I imagine it might not be.
Okay. So a lot of people think that frugal innovation is like you're cutting costs to the bones, you know, like you're doing cheap things and so forth. Well, it's not only that. Frugal innovations meaning that, say, you come to Malaysia from United States. United States has $1 million equipment. They have 12 SEM. SEM is this huge scanning electron microscopes in one room. Okay? And you come back here and you have to, some are functional and some are not. Maybe it's not available all the time. So frugal innovation is about this. You see the constraints. Okay? Resources are available around you. How do you use and utilize these resources to the max to achieve the same objective as you would achieve in a $1 million facility? Now, it sounds like, you know, idealistic, okay? But if you're there, for example, I give you an example, instead of using expensive silicon substrates, which is used to make microelectronic device, why not use cheaper substrates, such as paper? Where even scientists in the United States are using paper, you know, they used to write, to make devices. And how much does paper cost?
There is an assumption, though, that we must use the most cutting-edge things because the reason why things are expensive is because they're the best. Is that an inaccurate statement?
Well, I wouldn't say that there is an extent that, you know, like expensive things are good. I give you this. You know when Apple first started, okay? They don't have the R&D that IBM has. They have really less. But with the few they have, it's not like they have zero, but they have something. They can produce a habit-changing technology. Apple iPhones, they go everywhere. So it's that thinking of, you know, it's not like, you know, if you of course you cannot start something with $0 or zero ringgit Malaysia. You know, you need to have something. But it's just that you might have 1/4 of what you have in the United States. So how do you use this 1/4 out of, you know, the whole big chunk that in the United States to do something significant? How do you do that? Maybe you need to collaborate with people. Work in a team. So, for example, 4 of my colleagues might have the things that I need. And I can't have all of them because money is not enough. You work together to achieve the same thing as this part where the United States have. That is frugal innovation. To be able to use what's there for you requires a lot of teamwork because you can't achieve the same objectives alone.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Amani Salim, Assistant Professor at the International Islamic University of Malaysia. We are discussing frugal innovation as well as her career in the United States and now back home. Up next, we find out more about what frugal innovation means in practice. You're listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, Dr. Amani Salim, Assistant Professor of Biotechnology Engineering at the International Islamic University of Malaysia. We are discussing frugal innovation. It's something that's often associated with poorer countries, perhaps just naturally due to the constraints that are placed on funding and resources. Would you say that that's generally how things have been?
Well, actually, believe it or not, United States is a big advocate for frugal innovations. What they realized was that they can achieve the same objectives that they were doing before with millions of dollars with less. And they're realizing this. How did they realize this? A lot of researchers I deal with is that they have traveled to third world countries. They have traveled to poorer countries and they've seen, wow, why don't we use the things in existing to achieve the same things? They are realizing it. We are at the heart of the things. We are here in a country that's developing, and we need it the most. So this is where, you know, we thought that it was just us who care about it, but it's not just relating to the third world countries or the poor countries. Even the United States, they start shifting in doing things expensive, you know, to something that is frugal, which is use less but achieve the same objective.
Who pioneered the concept?
Well, the frugal innovation, I've heard from many types. I don't really see someone who pioneered the concept. But what I've seen is that there's a lot of examples. One of them is in India, where they have a lot of innovations. You know, India, they have this mix of very talented and very smart people, but also a lot of poor people in the country. So they pioneered a lot of these frugal innovations, which the West started, you know, learning examples from these countries and starts to do these frugal innovations, yes.
One thing that occurred to me earlier when you were giving an example of collaboration,
yes,
of needing to come together in order to achieve the same things, I would imagine that one problem with this is that speed becomes an issue because you might not always have access to the things you need. You might have to, and collaboration is naturally going to be a slightly slower process than trying to do something alone. So does that mean that people who practice frugal innovation might by necessity always be a few steps behind when it comes to coming up with things?
So I always, when I do my research work in the United States, you have to have a balance between doing things fast because science progresses very fast, but at the same time, you want to do the right thing, okay? So in terms of challenges in collaborations and working in a team, yes, there is, especially in Malaysia where the concept of working in a team, even in the classroom, is not really something common. When I was in the United States to realize a NanoSat projects, believe it or not, you don't have a team, you can't do it. You need a strong team. even though those are million-dollar projects, similarly to frugal innovations. For example, if you go back to Malaysia, yes, you can do things, you know, in your lab and achieve something, but will it be high impact? You're looking for that impact. So I give example. For example, if I want to test, say, a frugal technology to test existence of E. coli in drinking water at remote villages, right? I need to collaborate with non-governmental organizations that actually take you to the site. If I don't have that contact, you don't know whether your technology is going to function or not. So that in itself is a collaboration.
You mentioned India earlier, and one of the first big things to embody frugal innovation is the $2,000 car by India's Tata Nano. But on the other hand, aspirational Indians did not want to be seen as driving the world's cheapest car. How do you get past a perception barrier like that?
So cars and watches, homes and so forth, it got to do with the society perception of
status
them.
Symbols.
Yeah, status symbols. But for example, if you want to test diabetes, what do you use? You use a strip, right? How much does a strip cost? Is this very cheap? Why is it cheap? Because it's used on very cheap substrates. They use on plastic or paper even. Okay, so it's invasive, of course. What if you do? If you can bring these glucose strips where everywhere around the world, you can bring it to village, remote village, because it's portable. So that is something, you know, I look more into, you know, medical devices or sensors for the environment, which people don't really need to see it. People need to know the results of it. Is there E. coli in the water or not? Can people use it safely? Will people get sick from eating this food? And so forth, especially with a hard hit flood that happened in Kelantan, in the east coast of Malaysia and so forth. I've been to the site and I've seen how people have no means of checking the drinking water that they're drinking, you know, from whatever, from the river and so forth. So having these two humanitarian who go to the site and do these water projects, which I'm involved in with one of these non-governmental organizations, which is MRA, Malaysian Relief Agency. So they do this filtration, water filtration project. How do you check whether the filtration is functional? You can't bring a huge microscope and all these, you know, testing that going on.
A mobile lab.
Yeah. So you can't even bring like a car full of lab equipment because it's hard to reach these areas. But you can bring these small devices which you put in your pocket, plug it into your smartphone and see the results. So these are the innovations I'm trying to go forth.
Was this something that you were thinking about even when you were abroad, or was it things that kind of started to come to coalesce more when you came home? Because I think the things that you're describing are quite specific, not just to Malaysia, but I think to developing countries. You know, for example, E. coli, water safety, food safety. These tend to be more the issues of developing rather than developed nations.
Believe me, like, I came back to Malaysia and I see the reality. I don't see that when I was in the United States that much, because you do technologies, you know, to answer fundamental biological questions. But the problem with the researchers in the West when they develop technology is that they don't know where to apply it to. I have a need to apply this technology. Because if you go, for example, in the United States, say when Katrina hits, you know about Katrina and so forth, then they start thinking, wow, we need these technologies to reach to these areas because you can't bring a whole lab to these areas. And I start thinking, wow, this is Katrina. If I go back to Malaysia, there's more needs here. So when I came back, and the most is I went to Kelantan after a week of the big flood, I just sat down and think, it's repurposing all my research just to help the community that's just near to me.
You, as I've mentioned, are an assistant professor within the Department of Biotechnology Engineering.
Yes.
And you've talked about how you've taught in the States, you've taught here as well. What work do you do and what courses do you teach, and how do you balance that out with your research work?
Okay, so as a researcher, what makes you really satisfied, I don't speak on behalf of everybody but for myself, is that if I can mentor and be the role model of the next generation of young scientists and researchers. And you get to know students through teaching. teaching can be in the research or in the classrooms. The classes I taught are bio nanotechnology. When I came back, the class were taught. Before, nobody taught the class because there is no real expertise or involved in the research in this field. I taught biosensors to the postgraduates. They love the class. My teaching rating is 90 above every semester. My types of questions even are open-ended. I put the questions in a real-life situation. Imagine yourself stuck in a place where there's no this and that constraints. How do you invent something with that constraints? Again, the concept of frugal innovation, putting students at the right situation. How do you solve problems given what is there? So this is something that I want students to think, because that is the real problem solving when you are on the ground and solving problem. So I want this real situational context to the students in my classrooms.
Finally, having said that, are we doing enough for science education in Malaysia? Because I know when I was growing up, that was not the kind of science class that I had.
So if I were to, I do get some experience going into classrooms in Malaysia here. Sometimes I feel that the content is there, but then there needs to be more hands-on, fun, practical approaches to teaching science. It's not just about getting the A in mathematics and science. It's not just the grade. Sometimes the curiosity in science comes when students do the actual hands-on things in the classrooms, and they were like, wow, it's not just about memorizing facts or the equations or solving, you know, these math problems and getting the right answer. That's not all about science. Science is about discovery. Even discovery of new things that you thought you never knew. And you found that, you know, this is interesting. And you want to learn about it more. And I give an example. I'm always a strong believer where your background, okay, the previous president of Purdue University, her background was she was an English major. Okay? She became one of the best astrophysicists of NASA. Background? English. How did she do that? Part of her career when she goes, she found out that science is interesting. She wants to do it. The system allows her to jump, to do that. So here, you know, we're more of like, okay, this is great, you go this science stream.
This is what you do from now on. Yes.
Yes. I think we should be, my opinion is that we should be a little bit more flexible in that, to allow students to explore, because at a young age, you don't really know what you really want to do until you're into it. So I think that's my sincere advice for us to go ahead in that direction.
Thank you very much, Dr. Amani. I've been speaking with Dr. Amani Salim, Assistant Professor of Biotechnology Engineering at the International Islamic University of Malaysia. We've been discussing frugal innovation. You've been listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.